listening and or watching Real Conversations with Jacob Young. Real Conversations is sponsored by Boys Town, saving children, healing families for over 100 years. Also brought to you by Lane Frost Brand, which is always made for the champion in you. Now, Father's Day is right around the corner, so don't forget to pick up your special man in your life, a gift from Lane Frost Brand, and be sure to use Jacob15 to save on anything and everything Lane Frost Brand. Now, guys, my guest this week is a legendary Hollywood cinematographer. He's worked with some of the biggest stars in movie history, including Barbara Streisand, Johnny Depp. I'm going to say a little hooray here. Hooray for Johnny Depp. And the one and only Freddy Krueger. He's a two-time Emmy Award winning for his work on television's Beauty and the Beast and Quantum Leap, another one of my favorite shows because I'm a sci-fi nut. His movie and TV credits are very, very long list, including Nightmare on Elm Street 3, Nick of Time, Heart to Heart, House, Burn Notice, and Elementary. Now, I had the honor to work with him last month on an indie film, Blood Before Bitcoin. Just watching him is a masterclass within itself. Kodak named him one of the top 100 cinematographers in the world. Now, my guest this week, of course, is Roy H. Wagner. You know what time it is. It's time to keep it real with Real Conversations with Jacob Young. Roy, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Man,
I hope I can live up to that expectation.
you know, it's so funny when I have guests come on, we delve deep and you have such an amazing resume.
I do.
Yes, you do, sir. Well, thank you again for taking the time to join me today. Now, we spent 2 weeks together in 100-degree weather near the Salton Sea in the California desert. Meeting you was obviously one of the highlights of the movie for me. You were such a great human being on top of all of your incredible talents. And you had your sidekick, your Chihuahua, Scarlet, with you. Lovely little Scarlet. Oh my gosh, there she is. Beauty. What a beautiful, beautiful baby. You know, tell me a little bit about Scarlet. How is this relationship, you know, for you? How'd that start?
Well, it started with my father died at 50 years old of an aortic aneurysm. So I've always been terrified of high blood pressure and all of that. And I've been very lucky for the most part not to have that. But then being a type A personality and being in this motion picture industry, it's very easy to get stressed beyond recognition. And so I was doing House at the time, and it was going through a lot of stress because the show had gone way over budget. On the first three episodes, they were ready to shut the show down. I got a phone call from the producer saying, we need for you to come in and take over the show. They were working 90-hour weeks, and I had to bring it down to where they were 10-hour days, working 5 days a week. And we did that the first week. But apparently it cost me. I began, my blood pressure started to rise, and I started taking the medication. The medication was crappy. It was horrible, miserable. And I went to my doctor and said, I'd rather die than take this stuff.
What was happening with the medication?
I was just dizzy and cranky and all the things that had happened with my father.
I see.
And so he said, do you like animals? I said, I love animals. He said, do you think they would let you have a pet on the set? And I said, probably. And so he said, well, you need to get an animal for your stress management. My daughter had wanted a Chihuahua. And so I'd always had big dogs never liked little dogs. So we bought her a dog by the name of Precious, her grandmother. And Precious was on the set with me all the time. Within a month of having Precious, my blood pressure was normal. And she's never left my side since then. She's been everywhere. She's been all around the world. And the truth is that she doesn't ask for anything. She doesn't want anything. She doesn't require anything. It's unconditional love. I've never seen anyone walk up to me angry. They always walk up with a smile on their face. And so what better accommodation than that?
It's such a special bond. I witnessed it and I saw exactly that, people coming up to you with a smile on their face. How can you be mad with a man holding a beautiful little Chihuahua? It's pretty awesome.
Took some getting used to when I was on elementary. Lucy Liu had a German Shepherd.
Oh.
And until the German Shepherd realized that Scarlett was the boss, it was a little treacherous the first couple of days. But then, you know, she got the idea and Scarlett straightened her out and they became really good friends.
Well, that is so great. I didn't, man. That's Lucy Liu having a German Shepherd on set, you coming in, I've got this Chihuahua. First of all, I've seen dogs on set. I've seen obviously companions. And of course we know these companions do so much for our mental health, right? As for your sake, keeping the anxiety, the blood pressure down. I know I've had three dogs myself and, you know, every time I pet them, it is an amazing experience because it does. It relaxes you. They relax with you. So great. I'm so glad you didn't have to take that horrible medication anymore and you were able to just, you know, utilize.
They sense your angst before you sense it. They understand what's going on with you before anyone else does. And I contend they probably care more than anyone else does. They don't require anything. I've always said that there are no bad dogs, only bad people.
Right.
Any bad dog that comes along has been taught badly by someone that didn't take care of it.
Well, it's funny you say that because my sponsor, Boys Town, Father Flanagan, said there's no such thing as a bad boy, only bad parenting.
That's right. It's the same thing.
Same idea. Mm-hmm. I love that. You know, for anyone who doesn't know, a cinematographer is a director of photography, right? The director of a film directs actors. In simple terms, people like Roy place the camera, choose the lenses, and light the scene. They create visual pictures. Roy is an artist. Roy, let's talk about you growing up in the Midwest. What inspired a Midwestern boy to pursue a career in Hollywood?
I was born in 1947 in a small town called Sykeston, Missouri, 20,000 people. There was no place further from Hollywood, including possibly the moon, than Sykeston, Missouri. I mean, it was just a yearning to get away from. I knew there had to be something better. It was all my family were farmers, and I just despaired when a circus or a carnival would come to town. That when they came to town, there was this energy and spontaneity and this magic that exploded upon the city or this little town. And when it left, it was all over. I mean, it was there we were by ourselves again. And so the next best thing was going to see a movie. And I remember when The Greatest Show on Earth was shown in our town, it was extraordinary. I mean, there was not anyone that wasn't touched by that movie. I mean, you see it today, it's a pretty good movie, but then it was a really good movie.
Right.
And people were lining up around the theater. And, you know, this was no movie palace. This was a little hometown movie theater. And the problem for me was, actually for my parents, was that I wouldn't watch the movie. You'd think someone that loved movies would watch the movie, but I would not watch the movie. I was turned around looking at the light beam coming from the projection booth. And in those days, people smoked, so the light beam would dance. It would, as the camera would pan, the shafts would go from dark to light. And this was just like magic. It was like a music show. And
so you're not looking at the screen. You're looking at the camera.
And they're looking at the projector. And my mother and dad would say,
oh, sorry, the projector rather. Yeah.
Turn around. You got to watch the movie. And I would turn around reluctantly. Those faces were giant. Where were those faces coming from? I mean, they were much bigger than anyone in that audience. So finally, after a couple of times going to the theater, my father arranged with the manager for me to go into the projection booth, which was, in those days, you know, that I grew up in times where racism was rampant, and the balcony was, no white person ever went into the balcony. That was colored people.
Right.
And that's where you went. And so it was a big deal for us to go up into the balcony and go into the projection booth. And I must tell you that I was very lucky in that I was raised by black people. And so I never had that.
You never had that stigma or feeling of that was something that was or indifference.
I was very lucky, and I didn't know how lucky I was.
Wow.
And you know, until many years later, but the truth is that we went up into the balcony, and there was this big steel door, and right next to it were these glass windows where the light was beaming out of one of the windows. And we opened the door, and all of a sudden there was this explosion of noise and clatter. It was like, you know, horror. It was like a factory. And we went, climbed up the stairs into the projection booth, and there was these, I can only visually portray them as dinosaurs, these big black things that made this enormous amount of noise and billowed carbon smoke from the light source. And right. then this shaft of light that went out into that window, out into the auditorium. So I was a little frightened, and projectionist put a stool next to the projector that was running, and he sat me on it, and he said, "Take a look in here." And there was the film was running past the light source, and it was upside down, mm-hmm. and it was not moving per se. It was still pictures individually moving past that light source.
Right.
Because it was moving, it looked like it was a movie, but it was still pictures. And he showed me on a bench that these were all just individual still pictures running at 24 frames per second. And this was like mind-bending for me. I mean, it didn't make any sense whatsoever. I barely understood what I was seeing anyway. And for him to begin to tell me all of these things in the 1950s when we didn't even have television yet. So he said, what you need to do is, if you love movies, you need to take a book with you to the movie theater. And at the beginning of every film, you'll see the name of a director of photography. Write that person's name down in that book in the name of the movie.
This guy who was working in the projection booth gave you this advice.
That's right.
Wow.
Just a crank, a guy that was, you know, nothing more than probably like a machinist would be,
right,
in a factory, except probably less educated. But he said, this is the person that makes the movie, makes that picture.
Wow.
And so I started doing that. And within 6 months, my mother and dad loved to go to the movies. Within 6 months, I had quite a list of cinematographers. And so I began to think, what movies did I like the best? Obviously, I didn't know what was good photography or bad photography. I just knew what I loved as a film goer. And to jump further forward quickly.
Well, what made you, this young guy from the Midwest, make the quantum leap to Hollywood?
Here we go. So I needed to get out of town. I knew that I needed to follow the circus. You know, the carnival. I was not happy being a farmer. I was not going to be happy being a farmer or a shopkeeper, my aunt and uncle in the wonderful clothing store. But I knew that that was not going to be it couldn't be. There was just something beyond yearning in my heart that said, I've got to follow that dream, whatever mm-hmm. that is. Now, here's a weird thing that I did not know at that time. I didn't know until after my mother died when she was in her 90s, and she told me the story before she died, which when she met my father, my dad was a baseball player. He loved baseball. He was he played in the minor leagues with St. Louis Cardinals. And this was before I was born. And I never could figure out why my dad was so obsessed with sports. I mean, I was the furthest thing from sports. But my dad was really obsessed with sports. We used to go to St. Louis. We'd meet a Dizzy Dean or Stan Musial, or, you know, we'd go to the baseball games and go have dinner with these people. They didn't mean anything to me. But they did to my father. And so by the time I was born, my father was an airport manager in a very small airport. And then he was a mechanic for Caterpillar. Mm. Caterpillar tractors.
Yeah, diesel engines.
Yeah. And he was a good guy. I mean, he came home on time. He didn't drink. He didn't do any of the things that modern men generally do. And I always thought he was just a really good guy. What I didn't realize was that my mother took him to the doctor before they got married to get their physical. Mm-hmm. And the doctor said, if you don't stop playing baseball, you've got major problems with your arteries.
His heart.
You'll die before you're 50. Mm. And so my father, my mother gave him an ultimatum. I won't marry you if you don't give up baseball. And he gave up baseball.
Wow.
And I didn't realize, but as I look back on my relationship with my father, he did not want me to be in the movie business. He wanted me to be
a farmer. Writer.
He wanted me to be a writer. He wanted to be, he loved sports. He knew I didn't love sports. He wanted me to do something other than that. He thought the people in the movie business were fairies. They were gay.
Yeah. Well, because in those days, that was the perception, wasn't it?
It was, and there was some truth to that, and there was some truth to it, you know, now. It's always been sort of a multi-cultural industry, and I think that's the arts. It's always been that way, and
right.
I think that people that have this yearning tend to be more eclectic.
I like that terminology. I think that's perfect. Yes, we are an eclectic bunch, for sure.
We may not all be gay. We may not all be whatever, but we are... We don't have commonality with a lot of things. There's this yearning and desire to communicate something that's with our mind or heart that we have to tell other people. And that's why some people are crazy enough to give up their life almost like a preacher and go out and spread the gospel of what's in their heart and their soul.
Right. Yeah.
And so
you were saying about your father.
Excuse me. I'm getting over being in the desert.
Trust me, I'm still getting over it myself.
my father had this. The last thing my father said to me when he was in the hospital, the night before he died, was, "Whatever you do, whether you're a garbage truck driver or whatever, you want to be a cinematographer or whatever, do it to the very best of your ability. Follow your dream." And don't let anybody ever steal your dream, especially you, because he said, you'll be the only one that can steal your dream. Mm. And that didn't mean anything to me at that time. But now, as I think back on it, that's what he did. He gave up his dream, not really knowing where Hollywood was, but knowing that's where movies were being made and that's where I had to go.
Yeah.
How in the world was I going to get there? This is... As I said, it was as far away as the moon.
Well, you definitely connected those dots. However that was possible, you made that possible. I know we talked a little bit about Harry Stradling and like how that became a big influence upon you and taking a...
That was Harry right there.
There's Harry right there in the back. So let's talk about that story for a second. I mean, how did that come about? Why would that pop up into a young Roy's mind?
Eight or 9 years old. I'm in a library, town of 20,000 people, tiny little library. I hear a man say, "Do you have a Los Angeles phone directory?" to the librarian. And she said, "Oh, sure." She pulls it out. Of course, it's not one book. It's many books. And, I thought, wait a second, I can look up these old cinematographers' names. I'm looking through the phone book, and it's huge. And, you know, obviously there's a lot of people you don't want to call Bob Smith because you're probably going to get the wrong Bob Smith.
Yeah.
But there were very few Harry Stradlings, and I got a hold of him right away. And because he was the sucker that answered the phone, I wasn't not going to turn loose.
And and so he answers the phone. What do you say? And
I said, my name is Buddy Wagner. I love your movies. I just saw Easter Parade. I think it's beautiful. And I want to be a cinematographer like you someday. He was very kind. He thought it was cute. My wife and I talk about this all the time. I mean, she grew up in Hollywood and she can't figure out why a Hollywood cinematographer would spend the time talking to a punk ass kid like Roy Wagner.
Buddy Wagner.
Buddy Wagner. Because my father's name was Roy. My grandfather's name was Roy. I was not going to be Roy. I was going to be Buddy. I never even liked the name.
I like the name Buddy. I love Buddy. I say that to everybody. I'm like, hey, Buddy, what's up?
But you know, when I came to Hollywood and I saw these old men, everybody called each other. They'd either be Frankie or Bobby.
Johnny.
And they were 90 years old. And I'd say, these guys are not Johnnies. These are not Bobbies. These are old men.
Yeah.
And I said to my brother who came out with me, I said, do not ever call me Bud. Don't call me Buddy. I'm Roy. I did not want to be called Buddy Wagner as a cinematographer. So no, very few people know that my real name is Buddy. But Harry did. And Harry, he thought it was charming. He thought it was cute that this kid, I was asking stupid questions. It was nothing smart. I knew nothing about photography. I didn't even know what he did. But I knew that he was a god. He was a king. And this, I was talking, he had this horrible Yonkers accent, which was hard to understand. But he was very kind, very patient. And I learned this from all of his careers. He didn't sound like he was a very intellectual man because of his accent. But he was an intellectual. I mean, he worked on Streetcar Named Desire and My Fair Lady and Picture of Dorian Gray.
First of all, so those first two movies are some of my favorite movies in Hollywood history. By far. Streetcar, My Fair Lady, fantastic. And this is the guy you're picking up the phone, calling the operator and saying, can you put me through to Mr. Harry Stradling?
Through that number, yes.
Wow.
And we didn't have dials on our phones, but you had to pick up and talk to the operator.
Right.
And so it was a big deal, and it was quite an expensive thing as well. I mean, my father found out later that I was calling Hollywood, California, and he was not very pleased, but we negotiated a deal where I was allowed to do it. But Harry was very patient. He answered my questions, and he said, hey, anytime you come to Hollywood, look me up. Well, that was not going to happen because I was never going to get out of Sykes, Missouri, but I was going to try. So this went on for about 6 months, 8 months. Once a month, I'd call Harry, called a few other cinematographers, well, Floyd Crosby, Joseph Ruttenberg, George Fulton.
And you were able to get through to all of them?
Yes, there was only a couple that hung up on me, and the rest of them were very kind. And all I have to say is, you know, I've been talking to Harry Stradling, and bang, you know.
Yeah, everybody's like, oh, Harry, he's my man, he's my boy. Yeah, yeah, we were out at one of the restaurants there in Hollywood, hanging out.
Yeah, they all played cards together.
And, sure.
So, Harry Stradling, yeah, yeah. But, you know, how old are you? I'm 9 years old. I'm Buddy Wagner. I want to be like you.
I'm the next biggest thing, baby.
And so, you know, it was cute. So one day I talked to Harry and he said, where do you live again? I said, Sykes, Missouri. And he said, where is that? And I said, it's in the very southern part of Missouri. He said, do you know where Paducah, Kentucky is? And I said, no. He said, put your father on the phone. So mm-hmm. He talked to my dad. My dad said, yeah, it's not far away. And he said, well, we're going to be shooting a film partially in Paducah, Kentucky during this period of time. Do you think you could bring Buddy to the set? And my dad said, okay. So my mother and dad and my brother all climbed in a car and drove to Paducah, Kentucky. And you remember I told you about how going to the circus and the carnival was such an
extraordinary experience. Magic.
You can watch the movies about carnivals, and it always shows the impresarios. They're all bigger than life, and even though they're probably sleazy people in real life.
Hey, what are you saying about carnies?
Yeah, exactly. But we're all carnies.
We're all kind of like shifters. We all kind of roam around this planet as a carny, right?
And so we went to Paducah, Kentucky, and just like at the circus and the carnival, there was all these trucks and all these people, and they were all dressed in beautiful tweed, and even the laborers had ties on, and it was all like they were going to church. And I'd never seen anything like that. And not only that, but everything seemed to funnel from outward in. They all seemed to be focused onto two people, the director and the director of photography. Elia Kazan, the director, and Harry Stradling, the director of photography. So I was there on the set, facing the crowd, and Andy Griffith was there, Patricia O'Neill, and Harry, and I behaved myself. And he thought, you know, I was this very serious young man. I really wanted this. I was very interested. I didn't leave. I didn't go stand around and act like I was a little boy. So he allowed me to continue this journey with him, which is something I've done with every, I mean, I did it with Chuck, your director of photography in your movie. Mm-hmm. I have tended to try to do everything that Harry did for me, I've tried to do for other people. This is a very treacherous business.
It sure is. Yeah. And, you know, I feel that same responsibility as an actor, because I get that question all the time from parents. I get it from other young aspiring actors. And I feel it is my role, maybe something I because people have passed down information to me and took me on as a mentor, and for me to help mentor the next generation of creative people, and to help them navigate that. So that's incredible. And, not many people would say that though.
Well, but success or fame is not useful. It's not useful for anything unless you can give it away. You don't sleep any better. If anything, you sleep worse. And it's like fat. So it's critically important that you give away what you're given.
Right. Now, talking about giving away what you're given. Now, my stepmother, who I grew up with, I was from a divorced family. I was the youngest of four children. So when my parents got divorced, I was barely 9 months old. So I grew up in a family where I knew my stepfather and I knew my stepmother because both my parents remarried. Now, my stepmother, Joni, she was a huge photographer. She loved photography. She loved taking photos. And the first time I was exposed to any kind of real photography was Ansel Adams. And she would hang Ansel Adams photography around the house. Now, you studied with the iconic photographer Ansel Adams. You know, and anybody who doesn't know, look it up. All you got to do is look it up and you'll just see image after image, these beautiful black and white photos of the American West. What is one of the biggest lessons from him that you learned that you've incorporated into your work,
Roy? Well, Ansel was a sort of a weird meet for me. I was in the Air Force. I was a combat cinematographer in Vietnam. And we were transitioning from a base that was in Hollywood Hills to a base in San Bernardino. And my commander, my boss, was an ex-civil servant who had been in the military before, but had been brought back because of Vietnam. He was an animator at Disney. He knew a lot of people in Hollywood. And he kind of got the idea that this, I was not typical. I was not just someone that had reluctantly gotten into photography in the military, because they always put you where you weren't, really didn't want to be. And so he said, look, I'm going to make sure that you get time to go into Hollywood and do the things you want to do. It's called OJT, on the job training. So I went on set of Funny Girl, which Harry photographed. I went to lots of different places and spent a lot of time instead of, you know, doing G jobs for the military. And one of the things he said, I think you really need to learn about photography. And I said, okay. I didn't care anything about still photography. I wanted to be a motion picture photographer. He said, you need to know about this. And I asked Harry about it. And he said, yeah, that's a good idea. I think you should do that. You have to understand, at that time in the 60s, Ansel Adams was no big deal. Right. He was a big deal, but not like he's become this legend. And so there was a military base, I think it was Fort Ord, that was near there. And I would be sent up for a week or a few days for OJT to work with Ansel Adams. And he was very sweet, very kind, but he said something that really irritated me. He said, You're not a photographer. You can't control the final image. He said, I can control the final image here. I only have one image I have to manipulate. But at 24 frames a second, you can't control the final image. It better be there on the negative or you don't have anything. And he said, that's fine, but all of my work is done in the darkroom. It's not done at the moment of capture.
Right.
But he said, here's what you need to know. My work as a photographer in the field is pre-visualization. I see what I want that picture to look like. And I determine, how am I going to get that? Mm-hmm. What do I need to do as far as the lens, placement of the camera, exposure, time of day? How am I going to capture that? And that's pre-visualization.
Like a manifestation almost.
Mm-hmm. It's how you see things. We all see things as we perceive them, not as they are. Mm-hmm. But as an artist, you really have to kind of reinterpret for your goal or your vision of what you're trying to communicate to people. Mm-hmm. And that's what I learned from Ansel. And I never went out with him in the field. By that point, his hands were arthritic to the point where it was very hard for him to do anything. So I spent time with him in the darkroom. And it was the best thing that ever happened to me.
Right.
The best cinematographers started in darkrooms.
Yeah.
Motion picture darkrooms. But they started George Folsey, Charlie Lang, Harry. All of them started in the darkroom so they could see the procedure, the methodical process of what it took to create not just an image, but an interpretive image.
Right.
And as an artist, as an actor, you read the lines in the page, but you're the interpreter.
Of course.
You're following your journey as that character. As a cinematographer, I'm following your journey as a character, following the arc of the story.
That's one thing I can say that I really appreciated about working with you is you really, there's so many people that are so stuck on a vision that, you know, they don't allow the interpretation to happen. One thing that I feel so blessed working with you was you would say, do your thing. And then you would see it and build it around the idea of what the actor is doing. You saw the movement, you made no qualms about it. You said, move around, do what you want to do, which that's something that I'm not used to because so many people are so technical in their idea of how things, that manifestation, that preconceived idea of how the scene is supposed to unfold or whatnot. But it was really, really magical to experience that. And also very like, I don't know, it opened me up in such a different way when I just felt like I could be free. So I want to say thank you, first of all, for that. And where did that come from?
It came from many years of fear because I knew what my vision was. I knew how to create that vision. I knew how to get there. I didn't want anybody to get in my way of creating my vision. But what I didn't realize was it is not about my vision. I'm just a collector. I'm a collector of everybody's dreams, everybody's goals, and everybody's vision, and including my own, and following him through this path, this very narrow path to the reality, the only reality we have, which is that piece of film. That is the only truth that exists. Whatever you see on that set doesn't matter. It's not there. The only thing that exists is there, right there in that piece of film.
Got captured.
And so if you don't think of it as a technical, you know, putting a car back together, putting the right screws in the right place, if you just think of it as a celebration, as this joyful romp through the woods with all of your friends, finding the right flowers, finding the right things, you have this incredible journey for the rest of your life that will not be broken by a wall that you've constructed for yourself and saying, I can't do this. It's got to stop here. Because if you allow people to do those things that should not be allowed, you're going to find things out about that character, about that story, about that location, about your contributors, the director, the film editor, the script supervisor, the actors. You're going to find out things about that instinctually instead of intellectually. Because we all read everything intellectually.
Right, of course.
We are forced to step in front of that lens that does not lie.
And it does not.
It's all instinct.
Now, when people like...
We don't even know what we're doing because we have intellectualized everything, but there's a point where that goes away.
Right.
And now it's just you and the truth.
Mm-hmm.
And so I have to say that 99% of my career, I've shot these things, intellectualizing them, thinking what they should be, listening to all my co-contributors, capturing on film, and not really realizing the depth of that story or those characters until I saw it all cut together, maybe a year later.
Yeah.
And go, oh my God, I didn't realize that's what that meant. And, you know, your soul and your heart and your mind process all that stuff. But it had to be processed through you as a person.
Right.
And that's what became the truth.
And through that experience. And speaking kind of that experience, when like people like Harry Stradling Sr. began working, there were no film schools. You know, those pioneers were, you know, they were inventing the medium. And today we have schools that they can go to learn these technical aspects of filmmaking. What are some of the things that can't be taught in a school?
I teach a lot. I go around the world teaching. The one thing I keep getting asked to teach is how to survive. It's not about where do you put the camera.
Right.
There's no right place to put the camera. It's not about right. Where's the proper place for a lighter? What's the best lighter? What's the best lens? There is no such thing. There's only you and the truth. And you can do this little film that we just did.
Mm-hmm.
And it certainly boxed us in as far as what we could and couldn't do. But I don't think anybody's going to be standing in that audience like Chuck or Nick or yourself and saying, you know, we didn't really have the time to do this. The audience is going to have to follow that journey and either accept it, like the film, or not like it.
Exactly.
They don't care about how long it took for you to light that shot.
No.
They don't care if you didn't have the right lens or any. They don't care. All they want to do is be
entertained,
brought into that magic.
Yep. You've worked with a lot of really, really big stars over the years. Are there any personality traits that you notice that big stars have in common?
Not really. Whimsy. Most of them, the big ones are very whimsical. Until they get to the point. Here's the problem that you have with being successful in anything. You get to a point where the things that made you successful, the things that made you good, you don't know what they were. Mm-hmm. Like Steven Spielberg doesn't really know what made him successful. He can say, "Ah, Jaws was what made me," or Duel, or, but he doesn't really know. Somebody else could have made Jaws and could have had the same kind of success.
Or not.
But the truth is that nobody really truly knows that instant of collaboration or that instant of contribution. What makes you successful? And so you'll see guys like Steven or successful actors who will follow this journey saying, "Well, I'm this person. And because of that, I'm that this person. I have this certain baggage or wardrobe that I can carry with me that is me." Got to get rid of all of it. All of it. Because you know now what made you successful than the day that you got into the business.
Sure.
And if you can throw away everything and start over every time, like you're a virgin, you're in a great place.
Yeah, that's a tall order there to get
you
that.
You have to do it every day, every moment. And that's why for me to tell you to do whatever you want, that's scarier than shit for me to say that.
It's scary for the actor too. That's because a lot of responsibility suddenly for the actor to go, "You want me to block my scene too?" And, but you know, there was such a freedom because, you know, instinctively as an actor or, you know, any artist, you instinctively have your emotion, your feeling, your, the way you're going to paint those broad strokes or small details. You already feel it. You instinctively read through it. You know, the moments of movement, but it's very rare, specifically in the mediums that I've done over the years, as far as daytime soap operas and 20 some years in soaps, everything is so finite and it's just A, B, C, D, this is your mark, hit this mark. And I became a technical actor because of those aspects, which I live and love and also regret at the same time, because when I've been, you know, a moment like when you said, "Just do your thing. Just go ahead. Let me see what you're doing." I didn't even know how to honestly, I mean, I did, but I don't know how to honestly interpret that, you know, as somebody who's so technical and has been trained technically.
You've got all the tools, having been a technical person. You've got all the wisdom and the knowledge of when you get into that sphere where it's mechanical and it's procedural, you know how to do that. So if you know how to do that, and then you can put it in your back pocket and just explore. You know, I worked with William Wyler, who was one of the greatest directors of all time. Mm-hmm. And I got to watch Frank Capra work and many different directors work. But one of the things about Capra and Mr. Wyler was they would do 60 takes. 60 takes.
Wow.
And, you know, studios would go nuts, but they were so successful that, and I asked Mr. Capra one time, I said, "Why do you do so many takes?" He said, "I'm wearing the actor out of the person."
Oh.
By the time they get to the 60th take, it's no longer process. It's no longer technical. They are
just raw. Pure, right. They're raw as all can be, stripped to the core.
They're not quite sure who they are, what they've done right, what they've done wrong. But what happens is that it wears them out to the point where they are vulnerable and they become like we are as people.
Yeah.
Which, you know, many times we sit and talk, we don't know what we're going to say. We don't know where we're going to move. We don't know if we're going to sit in that chair or drink that glass of water at that moment. We don't know any of that stuff.
Right.
And so if you can do that on the first take, put all that stuff in your back pocket.
Well, that's sort of the thing that I've always thought about too. Like with especially, you know, every young actor wants to be James Dean. Like at least I'm generations after that, right? Decades after that. But, you know, going to Hollywood as a teenager in the late 90s, you know, and you look up to these actors, you look up to like the James Dean, and they say, "Well, he was an exponentialist. He was confused. His acting was, you know, something like it was never precise. It was just raw." But isn't that what we're trying to make?
That's where Johnny Depp is. And when people ask me about Johnny, I always say, He's a little boy. No, don't put anything else on him. He is a little boy. He's got that naivete. He doesn't know his limits. He doesn't know when he's a bad boy or when he's a good boy. He's just a kid. Yeah. And he's vulnerable. And that's the way James Dean was. And many of those actors like that, of that ilk, with those, aren't, I don't see, think of them as stars as much as I think of them as great actors.
Right.
And Brando was that way. And Paul Newman was that way. They were vulnerable, and they were ephemeral. You couldn't pigeonhole them and say, this is what they are and this is what they do, because they didn't even know what they are or what they did.
Right. But that's what made it so honest and so pure.
And with Marlon Brando, I saw a documentary on TCM last night, which I loved. It was amazing, his documentary. And I knew Brando. And the thing that was interesting about him is he was combustible. Mm-hmm. You couldn't really grab him and hold him, because he could go in any direction.
Yeah.
And what's wrong with that? I mean, it's not the best living companion necessarily, but it is a person that is going to explore and help you discover the depth and the truth of your character, the depth and truth of your storytelling, in ways that if you just put all those proscenium drapes up and said, I have to stand on this mark and I have to make sure I hit that light, that's not your job. Your job is to explore the depth and the details of your character and how that relates to the other characters, and do that on the fly.
Right.
You're not quite sure how that other character is going to respond.
Yeah. I've always used that terminology. It's like playing tennis. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't know where the ball is going to go.
No.
How are you going to anticipate that?
You don't.
And if you think about it too much, that you're going to try to do that, then it's going to become robotic and it's going to become unrealistic.
Show called Party of Five, and there were five kids, five actors, and every one of them had their own method to their madness. And it was, oh my God, every one of them had to have a close up. Every one of them had, you know, and that was the studio. That's the way the studio wanted to work. And that was the beginning of a very stressful period for me, because I would watch the rehearsals and I go, oh, great. They're not going towards that window. That means I can put the light there. Oh, they're going to go in this direction. That's fine. Oh, I know how to figure this out. So I'd create a methodology to process so I could easily put them in that little box. And then I'd talk to the director and he'd say, oh, that's great. We'll do it that way. Invariably, they come back for makeup 15 minutes to half an hour later and say, you know, I've been thinking about this. And I don't think I'd go to that window.
And now you're back to the drawing board.
What have you done to me? And it was all about me. Yeah. And I remember specifically, there was a scene at night where there was people, a circle of people. Where was I going to put the camera? It was like a crowd, an angry crowd. Where was I going to put the camera? I mean, I could hand hold it or do whatever. And I literally did this to myself. It was like a come to Jesus moment. I said, what is your problem? You say you love being a motion picture cameraman. What do you love about it? At this moment of process and when you should be really loving that process, you're terrified. Your hands are clenched. You're dreading everything that's happening. If they don't do this, if they don't do that, what's the worst that can happen to you? It could be dark. There'd be no exposure. They'd be all black.
Yeah.
Well, you know how to expose. Well, the light would be in the wrong place. Well, you know how to put the light in the right place. The camera could be in the wrong place. So what's the wrong place? And that's simple, a process for me, which took less than 30 seconds. All of a sudden, it was almost like something had flown out of my body. And I suddenly had this freedom that I cherish to this day. I will never get rid of. I will say the things you're not supposed to say. Go wherever you want. Stand where you want. You walk out of the light. Wow, that might be interesting. That might be the moment where you want the audience to hear what you're saying instead of look at you.
Right.
Oh my gosh, that's freedom. So I'm not the custodian of this. I'm just a part of the journey of just getting to that truth.
It is truth. And speaking of that, you've been made a living of obviously in show business, and it can be challenging no matter what position you are in the process of making a film and or a TV show. What advice, the advice you would give to a young person that wants to break into the business?
The worst day of your life, you're still following your dream. Never give up on your dream. Never. And don't let anybody steal your dream from you, especially yourself. Allow yourself to be a part of the journey. Don't be the journey. Mm-hmm. Allow yourself to grow. Reinvent yourself every instant of every day. Don't become an autocrat. Don't think that you are. You're not are. You are them. You're us. You're a part of the collective. And if you're that, I'm 75 years old. I feel like I'm still like a child. I'm still a child following this journey. I'm as excited every moment of the day. I'm as excited when I wake up in the morning to hope that there's something on this path that I've never seen before, that I've never done before. And that you'll meet people. We met. I never ever knew who you were. I'd never met you before. Met a lot of wonderful people on that show. And it's just part of that journey.
It is.
It's the circus coming to town. And we're all carnies. We're all screwed up. Every one of us. But that's part, you know, any civilian, any human being that doesn't think they're screwed up is a fool. Mm. And the truth is, we all are, but we can allow ourselves that. And it's a part of the Pied Piper and all of us kind of leading each other along this path. We don't know where it's going to go. Mm-hmm. We don't know what's going to be. We don't know what's ahead of us. We don't even know, you know, you said something early on about I've got this legendary career. And I said, yes, but I had no clue that I was going to have that legendary career. I had no clue that. I look back on my career, and before I did Nightmare on Elm Street, I did this little movie that was George Clooney's first movie. It was a little tiny horror film, and the assistant director on it was having a horrible, horrible time. I helped her get through it, she said, "When we're finished with this, I want to do another film with you." You hear that all the time.
Yeah, and, of course.
So I didn't know who she was. Rachel Talalay, she ended up being the producer of Nightmare on Elm Street. Mm-hmm. She insisted on my becoming the director of photography. And it's like one of my dear friends, Conrad Hall, said, I was Conrad Hall the day that I did the worst, crummiest movie I ever did. But someone else told somebody that I was the next up-and-coming cinematographer.
Sure.
And it's not because of me. It was because of somebody of influence saying that, that I became this person that was bigger than I could ever be.
Oh, I doubt that, first of all. One, I'm going to disagree with you because you already had that work mentality. You started it at 9 years old. We just talked about that. So they obviously saw that in you, too. That's a special thing. You created a special connection to something that couldn't be further away. And you were able to do it at 9 years old.
And I have not a clue what was in there. I know part of it was my father's yearning and desire to follow his dream, but I haven't a clue what could have connected that little boy to leave his family, travel all the way around the world, in fact, Hollywood, to a place where I knew no one really, and start over.
Everyone on this podcast gets to take a trip in the Jacob Young time machine. Yes, you too, Roy. What advice would you give 12-year-old Roy?
Cherish every moment. Cherish every moment. There are times when I reflect upon a moment in time on a Christmas day on a farm, where the sky is totally dark and it's cold and it's bleak. And it's the Midwest, it's flatlands. And I think of that and think, why do I think of that moment? Why is that moment so important to me? why is that moment so important to me? Next to my aunt and uncle's house one summer, when I'm standing looking towards the west and saying, I have to go there. What is it in the middle of the night? And I know this sounds really theatrical, but it's true. In the middle of the night, I hear a train in the night. I'm wondering, where is that going? I want to go there. And insisting when we would move, because we moved a lot, insisting that my bedroom always had to face west.
You made that decision.
Mm-hmm. Nothing was going to stop me. Nothing.
So your instinction was already in place. You already were feeling that. I just talked to my wife about this. I feel like, and maybe this is sort of what we're kind of touching on here. And it was random because I was looking at some sort of Instagram feed when this came to me, and it was talking about some people can be taught to be psychic and some people of course have intuition. And like my wife has certain intuition. I have a different kind of intuition. Her intuition is numbers. Like she's got this like thing that she can see. And if she wants it, she sees it and she'll act on it. I don't care if it's the lottery. I don't care if it's blackjack. I don't care, you know, whatever it is, but she will win. And she wins and she wins and she wins. I play the same thing. I lose. But I guess like there's this instinct with inside of us that is a desire that pulls you. You know, and that's what I'm saying is, I guess you knew that instinctually, that that's where you needed to be.
It's following your spiritual self. It's not, I don't think it's instinct. I don't think it's anything that we can compartmentalize and package that way. I mean, we are a compendium of parts from whoever our parents are, our grandparents are, the bloodline of who we are. Kind of makes up this DNA, spiritual DNA of who we are. And I think that even though there's no way for us to touch that, some people are more open to that. I think I am, is what we talked about with on set.
Right.
I think that people are more open to that and they allow themselves to embrace that. And it's not a metaphysical thing as much as it's something we all have. It's just there. And you either go out and cultivate it or farm it, but I have done it professionally.
Right.
And, you know, some people say it's a small voice. I don't know if it's a small voice. But I do believe that there is a part of our construct of who makes up who we are that is a compendium of 1,000 years of bloodline that's come before us. I mean, sure. it doesn't die with us dying.
It lives on
through us and the good and the bad.
Sure.
And I think that if you can allow yourself to do that, which your wife has done and you've done it in your way, and you allow yourself to celebrate. Celebration is everything in this world.
Hey, how important is it to celebrate?
It's all important. It's knowing when it's your darkest day and finding a way of enjoying that. Joy is a bad word for that, but again, you're alive, you're breathing, you're moving to your journey on into whatever direction it's going, whether it's dark, bad, good, whatever it is, it's a part of this journey.
A celebration could be something simple. Right.
Yeah. It's not even a thing that you go out and eat or do. It's just like, as you said, this legacy career I have. I mean, the more that I celebrate those moments, every moment of that, the more that you can look back on it and say, yeah, okay, it was a legacy.
Right. And we're going to continue to celebrate that with you.
Okay. Thank you.
My sponsor, Boys Town, their motto is, he ain't heavy, he's my brother. Meaning, back in the day when Father Flanagan created Boys Town, there wasn't a lot of financial needs that were met. and many handicapped children did not have the right medical supplies. So boys would take turns carrying boys that couldn't walk to class, to sports events. And one day father said, "Isn't he heavy?" And a boy looked at him and said, "He's not heavy, father. He's my brother." The motto meaning, in our lives, we've all had somebody carry us. Who's carried you, Roy?
Oh, nobody walks alone. I mean, everybody has carried me. Harry, obviously, my wife, my brother, my family, my children, everybody. There's an old song, it says, "No man is an island, no one stands alone." And it's the truth. You don't do this on your own. And that's why it's so critically important that I give away what was given to me, because it's if you don't do that, it's not your job to benefit from someone saying that was, boy, Roy Wagner was great. He did all this stuff. That's not a part of this. A part of it is giving it away. The freedom of giving it away is the most critical part. And it's really what's wrong with our world. We are so clingy to everything, thinking if we give any of it away, we'll be abandoned.
Right.
And then the truth of the matter is that by clinging to it, you abandon yourself.
Yes. Well said. Roy, I want to say thank you for joining me today. You know, you were one of my favorite, if not the favorite person to work with on set, because, you know, some of your catchphrases are so contagious, and we'll save that for another podcast episode. But everyone looked up to you. They learned so much from you, and you have an uncanny ability to fix a scene with the most simple changes. That makes all the difference. It was our good fortune to be able to work with you and have all those great words.
I with you as well.
Well, I'm looking forward to more of it soon.
Oh, good. That's very good. How's your football film coming along?
I'm sorry?
How's your football film coming along?
Well, that's it got pushed back another week, but that's happening. I'm heading to Vero Beach, Florida this weekend for the NASA film. I don't think you saw the short film that I put together about the Apollo astronaut John S. Bull. It's a sort of an underdog story, and we just received Best Director, Best Screenplay, and I got a Best Actor award for it. While we were actually, it was the last day filming Blood Before Bitcoin, and I'm heading to Vero Beach, Florida for another little festival, and I think there's some other accolades that are going to be handed out for that project. So, you know, we're all artists, and we're all just continue to beat that same drum and try to, you know, march
on our journey.
Yep. But thank you so much, Roy, and I look forward to our next conversation.